and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Juneau native and professor of international studies at Paiche University in South Korea, Dr. Jocelyn Clark. Her talk entitled Horse Dancing Over the Fences of Tradition, Korea, YouTube, and the Marketing of Culture in the 21st Century was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on January 18th.
Hello, my name is Lisa Falsko, and I'm CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's a pleasure to see everyone here today, and I'm glad you found us as we move downstairs. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program will be recorded for the radio, so if you could just put that on vibrate, that would be greatly appreciated. And during the Q&A portion at the end, if you could just wait for the microphone to come to you, that will help with our radio listeners at home. And speaking of radio, I'd like to thank William Toyer, who I think is hiding in the corner. There he is, who's recording for KSKA. This program will be available on the website, both ours and alaskapublic.org. It's available for download via feed. So just simply go to alaskapublic.org or to our website. At this time, I'd like to get on with our program and start with our head table. To my far left, we have Ms. Deborah Smith, who is one of our board members and is the chair of our waterfall committee. If you do not know about our waterfall adventure, please go to our website and see about the fishing opportunities for people this summer. And to her right, we have Chancellor Tom Case, who you probably know as the Chancellor of UAA. We also know him as a former board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And we are just thrilled to have a partnership with UAA to bring speakers to Alaska. And you can listen to UAA's radio today at 4 o'clock, where you will hear myself and our speaker talking a little bit more to the students and the public. And to his right, I'd like to introduce Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who will come to the podium and introduce our speaker, also a former board member and president of our board.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me here. When I heard that Dr. Clark was going to speak, and I heard that from you, Margie, I said, let's clear the schedule on Friday. I want to come over and listen. Now, I've been forbidden by my staff to do this Gangnam dance because I would really embarrass myself. I'm going to have to leave that up to Jocelyn. But I can tell you, as an Alaskan who has visited Korea over 30 times in the business of trying to export Alaska resources to Korea and build better relations between our two countries, I'm reminded of what Dixie Walker, who was ambassador during most of the 80s, said to us, which is, if you want to have good economic relations and good political relations between two countries, do what you can to understand culture. And that's very, very important to do. And we in Alaska have a living treasure with Dr. Clark. She has an impressive list of artistic and intellectual achievements, a tremendous amount of service to her community. She's a Juneau native who's now a professor of international studies at Paiche University, which I probably just mangled the pronunciation, Paiche, in South Korea, and I understand she first made the leap from Alaska to Asia at 14 years old as part of Juneau's sister city program in Hokkaido, Japan, and later she was an exchange student at Gifu Prefecture in 1987. She earned her PhD in East Asian Studies at Harvard University, writing on a Korean musical vocal genre, and she has a long background of musical study. She participated in the Sitka Fine Arts Camp, played the oboe with the Juneau Symphony, and was a member of the Asian Art Ensemble of Berlin. She studied in New York at Wesleyan University in Korea and in China and has learned the Japanese koto, the Chinese zeng, and the Korean kayagum. She is the founder, director, and producer of Cross Sound and Cross Sound Radio, and I've had the honor and the pleasure of having her play in my living room. It's a spectacular musical genre. And something which I would say we should all be very proud that an Alaskan is helping keep this tradition alive. She was winner of the Alaska 40 Under 40 Award in 2009, and her work also earned her an appearance in a book celebrating Alaska's 50th year of statehood. So ladies and gentlemen, we're in a situation right now in Alaska where a large part of our economic future depends on very good and strong relations with our third largest trading partner, which is Korea. And we just had the president of Korea Gas come visit the governor in Juneau, the world's largest LNG consumer, single consumer, very interested in our natural gas. It's time for this organization and all of us to ramp up our understanding of Korean culture and to do what we can through our schools, through cultural exchanges, through business exchanges to build stronger ties. And Jocelyn, that's to say that we're not only here for our amusement, but we're here for our future, and we're delighted to see you. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm delighted to be in Anchorage. Being from Juneau, even though I've lived in cities of millions and millions of people, I still get a little thrill out of coming up to our big city up here in Anchorage and, you know, having McDonald's hamburger or something, even though we have one in Juneau now. The talk that I need to give in Juneau is an hour and a half long talk, and I understood that today's talk would be 1 hour, and we've started a little late. So my talk's going to take us right up to the end of lunch. Those of you who need to go, please feel free to do so. And those of you who want to ask questions, feel free to stay a little longer and ask questions. I tend to be a slightly nervous speaker, so I've written everything down, so please forgive me for that. But the topic that I want to talk to, as thrilling it is for me to come up to Anchorage, I'm not sure how thrilling it is for you actually in Anchorage to have just a local yokel come speak to you at the World Affairs Council. But I want to assure you that I am living in Korea as an expat. And I'm not here at the moment, so I guess that makes it count as someone who can talk to you. And I do have big plans eventually to come back up to Alaska and reclaim my PFD if they still exist by then. Hopefully, if we're trading with Korea, then that might be possible. During my travels, I have to say that Alaska is never very far from my heart. It is the lens through which I see and compare the world, and this is particularly true when I'm talking and thinking about the topic of cultural loss. As a scholar and practitioner of East Asian traditional musics, with a focus these days mostly on kayagam, this is the stringed zither that is Korea's most well-known national instrument. You can see it there. I play the one on the top, although I started on the one on the bottom. Cultural loss has become a poignant and urgent topic to discuss, as Korea in particular surges into the global age at a pace far beyond what any of us here in Alaska have yet seen. Or maybe you have an Anchorage, I don't know. We have an in Juneau. So I think this topic is one that we understand in Alaska, or at least one that we should understand, or maybe I should say that we need to come to understand eventually. But what is different in Korea, which is a country that's 14 times smaller than Alaska, it's about the size of Southeast Alaska, with a population close to 15 million, half of whom live in Seoul, is that Korea spends more than 1% of its GDP on arts and culture, and the government is very involved, therefore, in how that money is spent. Quite a large portion of it goes to projects that relate to Korea's efforts at national branding, and this is what I mostly want to talk to you about today. National branding and all the things that come along with it, and all the things that don't come along with it, like traditional arts and culture. So branding is not something I think we've thought about very much here in Alaska. If we take the example of my hometown, according to the New York Times, this is just to like stick it to Anchorage for a second, Juneau, Alaska is one of the most visually pleasing small cities anywhere and certainly the prettiest capital in all of America. A byproduct of the late 19th and early 20th century gold rush, today, the city is nestled into deep, steep fjords on the inside passage of the Alexander Archipelago, where glaciers pour off vast ice fields 400 kilometers square. In other words, and this is true for Anchorage as well, we haven't really had a need to brand ourselves in Alaska. We're pretty, and apparently that's good enough for us. Alaska. We only need to hear this word and it conjures up images of a seductive, vast, pristine wilderness and perhaps our seductive ex-governor as well. So, not every place can be such an effective self-marketer as Alaska, I mean. Others need to make more of an effort, and so South Korea has taken a much more deliberate and self-conscious approach. South Korea's cultural transformation since the end of its colonial period and then following the Korean War have been truly breathtaking. During my personal experience of life on the peninsula over the past 20 years, immense changes have taken place. And one of the developments most striking to me has involved the ever-accelerating loss of what is called their intangible culture, meaning cultural forms embodied in people such as music. This is opposed to tangible culture, which refers to things that you can touch, so old buildings and work of art and that kind of thing. So with Christianity beginning around the end of the 19th century came Western music and a myriad of other habits from the West. Like today we have eating bread and drinking coffee. Here we go, coffee drinking culture. Wine, speaking English. And out of the Western influence culture of the 20th century has arisen a new generation in Korea who's well equipped to participate in global affairs as we currently define them, on Western terms of course. But the current generation seems to me more tightly than ever shutting the door on Korea behind itself as it steps out onto the world stage. Children grow up learning to write in English instead of learning Sino-Korean characters, which means Chinese characters, basically, and are able to compare Korea to many other foreign countries on command, but hardly any have seen the instrument that I play. I play the kayagum, as I said, they've never seen it. None of my students at my university has ever seen the kayagum or know any of the genres that are famous that all the instruments actually play. One of them is called sanjo. I'm going to mention that later. In a December 2012 interview on the BBC, North Korean propaganda artist and defector Sun Moo remarked that one of the hardest things for him to adjust to after arriving in South Korea was navigating all the English words imported into the South Korean language. He said, "I think the language was one of the hardest things to get used to. We," meaning North Koreans, "speak the same language, but in South Korea they mix in a lot of English words." The political philosopher and Harvard government professor Michael Sandel recently published a book titled "What Money Can't Buy: The Moral Limits of Markets." In an interview with Diane Rehm on November 29, 2012, Sandel offered the following observation. He said, "Over the past three decades, we've shifted from having a market economy to becoming a market society. There's a big difference between having a market economy, which is a valuable and effective tool for organizing productive activity, and a market society, a place where everything is up for sale. In a market society, market values and market thinking reach into just about every sphere of life." So when I heard this, I found myself thinking about this idea of market society in the context of South Korea's current efforts to brand itself for purposes of commodifying the country's culture for consumption in the global marketplace. In this branding effort, does Korea risk putting itself up for sale? Turning culture into money in a way that transforms culture into capital? In reducing its culture to a set of iconographic images, what will be left out? And will all that is left out of the official sales packet be lost in time? In other words, what will the national branding effort mean for Korea's national heritage, its language, its arts, its history in years to come? One cannot, of course, discuss cultural capital and national branding at this specific moment in time without mentioning Psy. Will. Koreans are all very proud of him for putting Korea on the map. And in Alaska, as far as I can tell, from completely, of course, empirical evidence, it is less Psy himself that is known, but his horse dance and all the parodies that have ensued from the version have ensued. So from the version singing Klingon to the Chinese dissident Ai Weiwei's handcuffed horse dance, this was banned in China, to octogenarian U.S. Senator Alan Simpson's Gangnam-style YouTube plea to American youth to work to keep the country from galloping off the so-called fiscal cliff, the newly elected President Park Geun-hye during her election campaign, UN General Secretary Ban Ki-moon. Pretty much all the politicians seem to get into the act. A pre-U.S. election cover of a Chinese magazine had the two American presidential candidates doing the horse dance. So all of this begs the question, is this the new Korean brand? Well, it might be if we could be assured that people, at least in the West, think of Psy as being a Korean. I've seen comments posted on the internet, though, with references like that horse dude dance or that Chinese gangster dance. I know nobody can say Gangnam in America. Everybody says Gangnam, right? So gang is equated with gangster often on the internet. It's actually Gangnam. So my American friend who runs a security agency in Korea, Rodney Johnson, noted that to Americans, it doesn't matter if Gangnam Style is being sung in Klingon or in Korean. If you don't understand the words, what's the difference? There are only two languages that matter, the one I can understand and the one I can't. So if it's not English, it might as well be sung in Klingon. And for those of you who are interested, you can find that on YouTube. I'm not going to play it here today. So for this reason, the implication for Psy's potential to exert intercultural influence of any lasting significance, that is, that he will wield any substantial amount of the soft power that Koreans may hope to gain from his success, are inconclusive. I would love to know what everybody here in the audience thinks today. You can tell me after my talk. I want to know, how many of you have, just a show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Korean Wave? Not too many. So in Korea, the Korean Wave's on the TV every day and every show, and they're always saying how proud they are of, like, Korea, you know, the latest success story from the Korean Wave. But since most of you don't know what it is, this is from the Wikipedia definition. So Korean Wave, also called Hallyu in Korean, meaning Han, meaning the Han people, and Ryu meaning a current, and in English we say Korean Wave. This refers to the increase of the popularity of South Korean entertainment and culture starting in the 1990s in Asia, and more recently in other parts of the world. We actually break it into two waves. The first wave was drama, the second wave is K-pop now. So as one put it, it represents a surge in the international visibility of Korean culture. The term was coined in 1999 by Beijing journalists surprised at the fast-growing popularity of Korean entertainment and culture in China. Although individual aspects of the Korean Wave are interconnected with each other, K-pop in particular stood out in recent years to become the most notable aspect of all. It has played a significant role alongside the spread of the wave and is generally regarded as the gateway to Korean culture today. The wave has had considerable impact on the South Korean economy as well as on political and cultural influence of South Korea. For example, in 2011, the Korean Wave added approximately $3.8 billion US to the revenue of the Korean economy. An American journalist from a California Daily newspaper described the wave as a pop culture tsunami flowing from South Korea to the United States and the rest of the world. From what I have seen, compared to the deluge of American pop that has inundated the Korean peninsula over the past 20 years, the Korean Wave, in America anyway, rather than a soft power tsunami rolling across the Pacific, is more like a ripple, indistinguishable from other rare waves of international culture that managed to make a mark on our rather insular cultural shores. This is not the case in Asia, however. Particularly in China, Taiwan, Japan, and also Southeast Asia, the Korean Wave has actually been a tsunami. I just had a concert in Turkey, and the taxi driver was just on the radio the whole time. When I arrived in Thailand in November for a concert, it was the front page of the paper. Thai was the front page of the paper when I arrived. So this has actually increased tourism from Asia to Korea quite a bit. The number of tourists who visit Korea reached 5 million in 2000, and estimates say that 10 million visited Korea by the end of 2012. It's reported that 22.7% of the tourists visit Korea to experience Korean culture or to see Korean pop, which we call K-pop stars. Again, this is a country the size of Southeast Alaska, and in Korea, the mass of visitors are not confined to cruise ships. Juneau, by the way, runs about 1 million visitors in the summer, and Alaska runs around 1.6 or 1.7, according to I didn't compare them on the web, but according to one website I looked up this morning, and these are 2009 figures. So by way of comparison, Australia, famous for its coral reefs and beautiful beaches, attracts around 6 million tourists every year on average. There's also a growing medical tourism industry, particularly in the field of plastic surgery in Korea, so that you can look like a pop star, a Korean K-pop star. In 2011, consultation fees for medical tourism reached $180 billion. Overall, as of July 2011, 81.7% of tourists were Asian. People from the Americas made up only 7.6% of the tourists, and people from Europe were at 6.1%. The Korea Tourist Service report also showed that 9 out of 10 tourists who visited Korea last year stayed only in Seoul. They didn't visit the rest of the country. So though I'm from the one-time number one cruise ship destination in North America, I would never purport to be an expert on tourism or on Korea's national tourism policies, but I have started to think about all these things together. Tourism, city branding, national branding, and the Korean wave, all in the context of cultural industries in general. And I spent several years on the Alaska State Council for the Arts, so we didn't think about these things actually very much, but I think everybody's starting to think about it these ways, and I think Alaska really needs to think about these things. So here in the digital age, all of these things are interconnected, and they've really become one thing. One of the large projects recently completed in Seoul is Seoul's new city hall, which was unveiled earlier in 2012. The architect happens to be the same one who designed much of my campus at Peje University, so I took a great interest in the project. Now there's Hallyu. This is the Chinese characters for it. So this is the new city hall. You can see the old city hall in front of the new city hall. Though the architect explains in his artist statement that he was inspired by the curves of Korean traditional architecture called Hanok. Wait, I put it in the wrong order. So this is Korean traditional architecture. I don't know if you think that looks like Korean traditional architecture or not. This is some detail from City Hall. This is during the daytime. At nighttime, it lights up with all these neon colors, and it changes. So they turn purple and red and pink and yellow and blue. You can see it from the, you know, there's often concerts and stuff on the lawn in front of the City Hall. So to everyone else, including me, it looks like a tsunami, perpetually poised to engulf the old city hall, which isn't to say I don't like the building, but that's what it looks like. And there's a new stream project. They uncovered an old stream that they had cemented over in Seoul. So there's this little stream behind it. You can, I always imagine that this big tsunami emerging from this tiny stream behind City Hall. So somehow to me, this building symbolizes not only the Korean wave, Korea's current national brand, but also Seoul's city branding efforts, of course, with a nod to older Korean traditions, at least on paper. So with regard to city branding and tourism, Seoul's new city hall represents what Chinese scholar Chan Tseng Oye calls accreditation strategy in city branding. An accreditation strategy makes use of significant events, like the Olympics, expos, G20 meetings, to draw attention to a place. It uses globally recognized branded tourist attractions like Legoland and the Guggenheim Museum to build up the appeal of a destination and taps into promoting established and well-tested types of tourist attractions because these attractions communicate specific positive messages to global audiences, such as film festivals and art biennales, or building spectacular icons with the intention to symbolize a place, like the Eiffel Tower or the Pearl Tower in Shanghai, Statue of Liberty in New York. As Oye pointed out, these do not make a destination unique, but attach a tacit badge of approval to a place. To wit, this place is a modern city that participates in the global age. It is therefore fun and trendy like every other capital. The result is that many consumers now experience a sort of serial reproduction of culture represented by these types of devices in each new place that they go. And the problem with that, it's not necessarily a problem, but one of the problems that you could think of for that, is that in a world where consumers of culture, without leaving home, can Google Earth themselves onto the plaza in front of the Eiffel Tower, such a templated and icon-driven tourism experience lacks the visceral sensation of being inside another's reality which is what I think so many tourists seek. Otherwise, you don't need to leave your house. You can do a staycation instead. And I think this is what tourists, even now more than ever, seek when they go abroad. I mean, a place's actual space and the natural materials and the space that it comprises, like its yellow earth or its peaty soil or its timber or its colors, and of course its sounds as well. I think that in part, it is this desire for the visceral experience of the other that motivates Koreans in Korea to eat bread and drink coffee and speak English and play the piano and the violin and feel the Christian hymns reverberating off cathedral walls. All of this can be seen to represent acts of cultural tourism and literally cultural consumption. In another book that I read, Richards and Wilson observes that as more cities and regions compete in reproducing and promoting themselves for tourism and culture, employing the same formulaic mechanisms, their ability to create uniqueness diminishes. Ironically, even strategies to avoid serial reproduction have begun to converge. Bilbao's great success at marketing itself as a place of cultural distinction with its very own Guggenheim has been undermined by new Guggenheims in Las Vegas, Berlin, Salzburg, Rio de Janeiro, Tokyo, Edinburgh, and Frank Gehry's in LA, Manhattan, Seattle, Prague, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The waiting list of cities for a Guggenheim kit, which is what they're called, now has reached 60 cities. In other words, the Guggenheim, by becoming a brand and allowing itself to be incorporated into the global system of value, has lost its distinctiveness. And I think that there's been a fight going on between Korea and China over the last year over a song, Arirang. How many of you know this song, Arirang? A few of you? You've heard it before. It goes like, it's Arirang, Arirang, Arirang. Everybody's heard it, right? So China registered this song as their own national heritage, and the Koreans were all up in arms. Of course, China did it. they registered it as UNESCO cultural heritage. And so last summer, this bleeds into territorial disputes, actually, because there's a lot in China's northeast. There's a Korean autonomous region, right? So they said, we're supporting our minorities, and that's why we're registering it, as to be inclusive of all the, you know, being a multicultural nation, they want to be inclusive of all the minorities. But Korean, being a monocultural nation, wasn't very happy about that because it was their, you know, unofficial national anthem. So Korea cross-registered. Beijing said it merely registered the song as part of the culture of ethnic Koreans in China, but many people in Korea believe that the move was an extension of the Chinese Academy for Social Sciences Northeast Project, which critics said was seeking to co-opt the culture of early Korean kingdoms into its own national territory. So it was a border dispute, actually. The move was seen as a precursor to registering those cultural assets on the UNESCO World Heritage List. In any case, Korea won in December and succeeded in its own application to UNESCO. So my fear regarding this is that Korea will soon find out what has been found to be true in so many other places. That is, as soon as you try to transform local knowledge as a form of intellectual property or a kind of cultural competitive advantage into a brand, you run the risk of that icon being swallowed up by the global system. On a much larger scale, if the nation state of Korea is to become a brand, the stakes contained in that risk are even higher. In a book called Paradoxes in the Mediation of Culture for Foreigners, Peter Muller wrote that every piece of art or cultural product belongs to and fits into a local, regional, and national canon. This canon is determined by the local tradition and value system, the source culture, which cannot be and is not necessarily demonstrated in its complexity to the foreign target culture. This target culture nowadays is often an international one, in other words, the global cultural market, and it has premises and interests that differ from those in the emitting culture source. Korea may think it's selling one thing, but the world may be consuming in its own mind quite another. Psy's Gangnam Style is a case in point. In Korea, it is a song about a guy parodying the upscale fashion and the lavish style associated with the trendsetters in Seoul's Gangnam district. That's where Gangnam is. Gang means river, Nam means south, so it just means a, you know, a little district in Seoul, a bureau in Seoul that's south of the river. Everything north of the river is Gangbuk, north of the river, and everything south is Gangnam, and then Gangnam itself is one specific district. So this is, of course, the it's like Ginza in Japan, or Fifth Avenue, New York. In America, as I mentioned earlier, of course, Gangnam Style is just a wacky dance by an Asian gangster. So, let's see, what time is it? Oh, we're running out of time. I'm not going to show you a video of the second Ai Weiwei video. Show a little. I'm just showing you the beginning so you can get an idea. So this is the second Ai Weiwei video because it was banned in China.
Oppan Gangnam Style.
So these all his friends got together from all the Guggenheims around the world, and it turned it into a protest song against the censorship.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Professor of International Studies at Paiche University in South Korea, Dr. Jocelyn Clark. Her talk, entitled Horse Dancing Over the Fences of Tradition, Korea, YouTube, and the Marketing of Culture in the 21st Century, was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on January 18th.
Oppan Gangnam Style.
All right, that's enough. I urge you to watch the rest of it. This thing is just like looping back on itself with nothing to do with the original, meaning of the song. So while questions surrounding Korea's international branding may remain cloudy, what is becoming clear is the brand of Korean culture, brand of culture Korea means to invest in inside of Korea. That's becoming clear. Among nations, Korea ranks near the top in the amount of public funds it puts into the arts and culture. And it is interesting to compare Korea's current cultural investment to the other ways countries are investing in their own cultural capital. And a lot of that investment is going into something that's called the Digital Media Center in Seoul. This means that the areas being developed are things that are involved in the global industries. And that is arts that have high value, which can be traded on the global marketplace. The Digital Media Center, it's called DMC. It has its own subway stop now, and I was teaching at Yonsei University over the summer, so I got to go check it out. It's not finished yet, but it's getting there. This is a world-class complex for the 270,000 jobs and $12 billion a year digital media industry behind broadcasting, films and animation, gaming, music and e-learning, and producing. So all the radio stations, all the TV stations, everybody's moved over to this island, which was actually a landfill. It used to be called Duck Island because it was famous for its ducks and orchids, but then it became a landfill, and now it's become an eco village near the 2002 World Cup stadium. This is just the design and the plan. Part of it, they have this huge building that are going to go up later. So in this way, Korea, and I suppose it would be hard to find any country on the planet right now for which this is not the case to some degree, but it seems to be of two minds both made up. Is it to be differentiated by globalism, or is it to be differentiated by its national roots? Recently, I returned from a performing arts festival in Thailand at Bodapa University, which asked its guests to address the question, how can we preserve national traditional practice and thought with regard to performing arts while at the same time growing new audiences? This question with regard to the topic of both national roots and globalism invites perhaps one of the most pertinent inquiries for our time for performing artists and arts organizations. Among the biggest challenges for Korean traditional music, how do we define it and otherwise think about it and how we perform it and how we work to develop its audience in Korea and abroad, is the issue of how best to nurture its musical aesthetic. That is, how do we cultivate a personal taste for Korean traditional music? And this question goes out for like new music and classical, I mean, any kind of art, I think. So in particular, how do we see it in young Koreans now so accustomed to the classical and pop music of the West, a desire to hear and reproduce their country's traditional sounds? Over a decade ago, Edward Said had already begun to notice the ways in which modern education and technology could threaten Western classical music. Music today, he said, at least in the West, is separated from other arts. Music requires a particular type of education, which is simply not given to most people. And as a result, it is set further apart. People who are familiar with painting and photography and drama and dance cannot talk so easily about music. Said's observation holds true for today's Korea, where to the extent that people receive a music education, music is the word umak, is not one that, and is not an education that includes national music, kugak. They have different words. The word for music in Korea does not include any tradition. I mean, this is not just Korea, it's China, Korea, and Japan. They have separate words for their own traditional music, and the word for music, which used to indicate only their traditional music, only means Western music. So in Korea and all of East Asia, umak, education, music education, reserves solely to Western music. And Western music, which arrived with in Korea, in the Korea's case, not in all of East Asia, but in the Korean case, arrived with Christian missionaries who brought schools and universal education to the cities, is for educated people, whereas national music remains associated with uneducated country folk. This is kugak. So Korea's first music department, complete with the country's first piano, was opened at Paejae University, which is where I now teach, in 1895. Paejae University, to this day, has no traditional music division in its music department. And when I reported for duty in 2009, I was told not to talk about playing the kayagam that I'd already studied for 15 years, as that would embarrass the school. Not one of my students had seen a kayagam in person before. In other words, you know, there's more to say, but I don't have time. In other words, 100 years before the invention of iTunes, Koreans, especially through their Western education system, had already acquired a strong taste for Western music. The modern technological threat predicted by Said and now fully manifest is simply serving to intensify and solidify those tastes. So among the tendencies we find inside the new realm of digital exchange involves a dynamic that the New York Times columnist David Brooks recently referred to in, on NPR is where I heard it. Maybe it was McNeil or, I mean, the NewsHour. referred to as epistemic closure. And I think at that point, the host said, huh? What are you talking about? Oh, this was on National Public Radio. So he was talking before the elections on both epistemology and epistemic closure. And he explained that epistemology is the study of what we know. An epistemic closure is being in an information cocoon where you just believe what you want to believe. Confirmation bias, he added, is another phrase, and there's a lot of that going around. So in his evoking the term epistemic closure, Brooks was alluding to a philosophical tenet under which, according to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, we enlarge our knowledge base by accepting things that are entailed or logically implied by things that we know. The set of things we know is closed, meaning that we know that a given claim is true upon recognizing that it follows from what we already know. So Brooks' use of the term is traceable to a 2010 blog entry by Julian Sanchez of the Cato Institute, who, writing on the political effects of conservative media in the United States today, observed that reality is defined by a multimedia array of interconnected and cross-promoting conservative blogs, radio programs, magazines, and of course Fox News. Whatever conflicts with that reality can be dismissed out of hand because it comes from the liberal media and is therefore ipso facto not to be trusted. How do you know they're liberal? Well, they disagree with the conservative media. And this this epistemic closure can be a source of solidarity and energy, but it also renders the conservative media ecosystem fragile. In this statement, Sanchez highlights the manner in which false consensus and groupthink readily result when media consumers get caught up in what he termed feedback loops with limited ideological realms. This is what Brooks means by confirmation bias, the common human tendency to favor information that confirms our existing beliefs, or by extension in the arts, our existing tastes. And what makes this dynamic relevant to our efforts to preserve and market traditional musics in the locking out effect is the locking out effect epistemic closure has on the new, whether new information or new sounds. I, of course, ran the Crosstown Music Festival for 10 years. I thought about this a lot. So, which today also include old sounds, because the old sounds are all new to the young generation who grew up with Western music. And as people enter with less and less frequency into the material sphere of the performance hall, substituting digitally transmitted performances for a night out, our potentially vast realm of unbounded selections begins to organize itself in the same kind of feedback loops referred to by Sanchez. Similar to his ideological and political loops over time, taste loops become reinforced through confirmation bias, breeding audiences less and less inclined to challenge themselves to reach beyond the familiar. And this problem of preemptive deafness is compounding exponentially as today's speedy devices prompt global consumers to access and purchase information in under a second from suggested pieces electronically offered on the basis of your previous choices. And we're all involved in this, and you know, even those of us in the arts. So given the central role played by the unfamiliar in any cultural exchange, it is not hard to see how this dynamic threatens the future of national musics that have already begun losing their moorings on challenging aesthetic tides, on changing aesthetic tides inside their country of origin. Feedback loops not only influence and instill aesthetic taste, but they are affecting funding, with products that reinforce more popular taste drawing more support. Joseph Nye had used the term soft power to describe a nation's ability to attract rather than coerce, using means other than force to achieve specific diplomatic and economic goals. Aware of the concentrating efforts of group psychology, governments like China and Korea seek to tap into the soft power to boost their image and increase tourism and otherwise create new revenue streams. And companies that provide funding in support of these ends increasingly tend to cater to the lowest common denominator. The money for popular arts, thus, starts spinning around in its own little feedback loop, sucking more and more into its vortex. And as a result, for example, local symphonies all over the United States are folding. In Korea, much of the funding for national branding vis-a-vis kugak, meaning national music, goes into what's called fusion. And these are traditional ensembles that incorporate non-Korean elements, ostensibly to cater to foreign tastes. The process of anticipating what foreigners will like often results in a kind of self-censorship of Korean traditions by Koreans. Under the assumption that Western listeners will not like Korean's traditional sounds, producers inject more of the West into Korean-made performances in hopes of making traditional sounds more globally accessible. And this injection of outsiders' perceived dislikes into the process of producing kugak fusion, or you know, national music fusion, creates its own kind of feedback loop that locks out international listeners from being able to access more authentic traditional Korean music. Cultural loss thus takes place in a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. The old teachers who grew up during times of great hardship are dying, and the Gangnam generation of musicians has little desire to preserve traditional practice. And traditional practice and thought, as these are time-consuming things that won't make you famous very fast, or ever. And it won't make you rich either, I can attest to that. So the national brand that the government and corporations want to sell the world is as Western as it is Korean, and the whole republic has by now grown up listening almost exclusively to Western music, so that increasingly, truly Korean traditional musics are becoming strangers in their own land. In other words, it's a foreign music in Korea, where understandably people heap upon the old traditions collective memories of all the cultural, historical, and social traumas the nation has endured over the past 100 years. So I want to show you this video, and I think this encapsulates a little bit like the tsunami does, what's going on in Korean music. This is because I didn't want to show you Gangnam Style either, even though I showed you a little bit. So this is a video that was made for the Olympics. And it's made by Tsai. It was produced by co-produced and co-written, it was co-written and produced by the Kugak National Kugak Center, which used to be called the National Center for Korean Traditional Performing Arts, which when I first arrived was called the National Classic Music Institute. I mean, in that you can already see processes happening. And in it, you see Zionist fans arriving at the Royal Palace, entering the Gwanghwamun, the gate that, you know, takes you to the palace. And all the traditional musicians who produced the video and had the idea for it, he sort of sweeps them aside as on his trip to the throne room. And of course, this is like the seat of, this is where the Joseon dynasty ruled from. This is where all the coronations happen. This is where the king, you know, talked to his ministers. And behind that is the Blue House, which is Korea's, version of the White House. So this is very much the walk of power in Korea. And then it ends with the song Arirang, which hadn't quite been settled before the by the Olympics happening. So I just want to show you this video. So he arrives with his fans, and then downtown Seoul, right outside the city hall, actually. It's not far from there. And I don't know why he's wearing a Turkish outfit. Conclude, And I skipped about 10 pages. So Barenboim asks, Daniel Barenboim asks, try and reproduce the past. The mere word reproduce is a sign of poverty. All indicators seem to point to a future where Korea's traditional musics may be preserved, but only as inanimate artifacts. Korea's once most creative instrumental genre, which I've been studying for the last 20 years, called sanjo, is already moribund, its improvisational heart having been memorized to death. All creativity is following funding, which is following taste, which is following a computer-generated algorithm designed to perpetuate a capitalist aesthetic, which I explained in the part I cut out. So fusion performances comprise Western pop or classical musical motifs with Korea's traditional instruments barely audible in the background. Songs such as Size Korea are fast becoming the traditional Korean brand of the future, ready-made for global consumption. But most assimilated peoples, in order to survive culturally, must sooner or later find themselves undertaking the process of unassimilation or cultural remediation, during which it becomes apparent how much of the original forms have been lost. One has to appreciate the irony inherent in the fact that the Western culture movements of romanticism and neo-romanticism, which Koreans have become so enamored over the past century, at least with regard to musical taste, often sought to create art that would re-enchant the land and establish or re-establish a sort of lost spirit of place. As I mentioned above, while the shapes of the traditional Hanok architecture supposedly inspired Seoul's new city hall, to me there is no building that better represents the Korean wave. In it, we see the hopes of the government and the people for the wave never to break, but to be constantly cresting. And in it, we also see a wave that is about to engulf the heart of the city of Seoul. In it is contained a force for destruction of what came before it, the city hall of the past and all that it might represent, standing right in front of the wave, roots or continuity. And in it, we also see a glass facade, a world brand, the culmination of an accreditation strategy that turns Seoul into a tourist beach instead of a capital filled with, you know, what they call in Korean, pungsu, feng shui in English or Chinese, and mountain spirits. If Korea is to successfully brand itself for the wave to continue rolling around the world, it must consider renouncing its facade in favor of revelation. This is to suggest that perhaps we should give up the idea of branding altogether. Official obfuscation of essential parts of Korean history and culture hurts both Koreans and outsiders interested in understanding Korea. And it is only when we step behind the branding facades to explore the multidimensional interior of each other's cultures that the world truly begins to expand. For the tourist who experiences these interiors rather than touring a series of McGuggenheims unconnected to place, a world made small by technology may once again be made infinite. The poet Colton, whose First Person Sorrowful was just published by Blood Axe Books over in London, rather sounding like a shaman, recently told The Guardian, "Half my generation died. I have this calling to bring back to life all those who have died. I bear the dead within me, and they write through me. Sometimes it's not me writing at all. It's they who are writing, they who are there, ahead, a live presence in what lies ahead." In these words, Cohen assures us that the genius Loki that animated Korea in the past continues to animate Korea today. If you're asking me, then I would say the best tourism strategy for Korea is for Korea to be unashamedly itself. When Korea allows itself to be known in all its historical and artistic complexity, it will succeed in delivering to its visitors, whether those visitors arrive on iTunes or in a lecture at the World Affairs Council or at Incheon Airport, what they cannot get from Google Earth, which is the visceral, the unique, the genuine, and yes, the messy experience of being Korean. And I mean South Korean by that. So thank you very much. And I'll take questions and we can watch videos if you don't have any questions.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Professor of International Studies at Paiche University in South Korea, Dr. Jocelyn Clark. Following her talk entitled Horse Dancing Over the Fences of Tradition, Korea, YouTube, and the Marketing of Culture in the 21st Century, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council, she responded to audience questions.
So, Paul Dunscombe, University of Alaska, Anchorage.
Hello.
So, I want to thank you for this very wide-ranging discussion. Talking about Korea being true to itself from a cultural standpoint, is it possible that, in many respects, it becomes easier to be that way if one gets outside of Seoul. So I think of, for instance, Gyeongju, which is very much dedicated to sort of celebrating its Silla roots, or a place like Andong with the Confucian Academy and various other things. Can a more authentic Korea be found outside of Seoul?
It's all there. It's just not being marketed. And it's not being, you know, branded as Korea. So it's not that it doesn't exist, although it doesn't exist among young people. And that's what's, you know, when I first came to Korea, I was there on a fellowship from the National Classic Music Institute, which is now the National Kugak Center. And that's a building that sort of houses national living treasures, or what we call intangible human cultural assets. And that building, you know, has two divisions. It has a folk division and a sort of court music division. And I spent my time there among practitioners of Korean traditional music. And I thought that the whole world, you know, Korea was all about traditional music as far as, you know, my world went. And soon after I arrived, this movie called Seopyeonje came out, which was a sort of very nostalgic view of the Korean traditional past. And it featured a genre called pansori, which is a story singing genre. And it was about a woman who, you know, wandered the countryside poor, and her father blinds her on purpose so that she can, like, find her voice. And there's a, like, resurgence of that. So this was, like, the biggest... This was the start of the Korean wave, actually, in film. It was the first Korean film that grossed... I mean, it was the biggest grossing Korean film of all time at the time. And then there was this, like... When I first got there, there was nobody at Korean concerts. And after that, you couldn't get a ticket for, like, years. All the students went to the Korean Traditional and Performing Arts Center. And there was... So I thought that everybody was interested, right? And so then I came back to Juneau, and I lived... Came back to Alaska for, like, 10 years, and I just went back to Korea. And... Then I arrived in Daejeon, not Seoul. I'd been living in Seoul before that. So I got to the countryside, which is, you know, 2 million people, size of Boston, countryside. And got to class, and not one of my students had seen a Koyagon before. They hadn't heard any of the genre names. They didn't know anything about Korean music, and they weren't interested. And then the school told me not to tell anybody I played the instrument. So I was really shocked. I mean, and now I'm giving lectures, you know, now I'm lecturing around Korea to Koreans on Korean traditional music is what I often do, and nobody knows a thing. It's unbelievable. I mean, I was really shocked because I really thought that, you know, my first experience in Korea was only around people who were involved in Korean traditions. And now I'm finding that things are different than I thought. In Seoul, it's a little bit, actually people know more in Seoul than they do in the countryside. Although you mentioned Gyeongju, Jeonju, all these things with Ju on the end that indicates like an old capital city, Gongju. There's lots of people who are still interested, but not a lot of young people, and I think that's where the problem lies.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Juneau native and professor of international studies at Paiche University in South Korea, Dr. Jocelyn Clark. Her talk entitled Horse Dancing Over the Fences of Tradition, Korea, YouTube, and the Marketing of Culture in the 21st Century was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on January 18, 2013. Next week on Addressing Alaskans, The Rise of the Creative Class with author Richard Florida. Recorded at the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation Economic Forecast Luncheon. Listen to Addressing Alaskans back again on Tuesday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. on KSKA. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.